Blog Talk Radio.
Finally, I'm finally free. Finally, I'm finally me. Finally, I'm finally free.
Of the Black Girl Nerds podcast. This is Jamie. I'm your host. That was Carolyn Malachi. She's a Grammy nominated award artist, and she has been so generous enough to donate her song, Finally, as our new theme for the Black Girl Nerds podcast. So she is a self declared Black Girl Nerd, and she will actually appear on our podcast next month in August. So tune in for that. Thank you guys for tuning in tonight. Really, really exciting. Our podcast is coupling up with the Blurred Book Club. We are interviewing today Cherie L. Smith, author of Orleans. I know you guys that are listening that's read the book, this is what you've been waiting for. You can't wait to discuss it. Before we get started, just want to go ahead and plug in the Blurred Book Club. Those that are listening that may not know about this club, we currently have over 200 members and counting. It seems every day more and more members are joining in. And if you go to www.goodreads.com and search Blurred Book Club, you'll find our group. And our selection for July is actually Wild Seed, which is a part of the Pattern Master series by Octavia Butler. So you still have time to go ahead and reserve that on in your local library or purchase that on Amazon. And then be sure to join the Blurred Book Club on Twitter as well, and you get the latest updates about the club and their members. And speaking of Blurred Book Club, we have Cynthia, also known as Unicorns and Glitter on Twitter. Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
She is the brainchild behind the Blurred Book Club. So I want to welcome her to the Black Girl Nerds podcast. This is her first time co-hosting with us. Cynthia, go ahead and tell us really quick what inspired you to create the Blurred Book Club, and then also give us your social networking shout-outs, any special projects you're working on, to all of our listeners.
Well, the Blurred Book Club was an idea that came about on Twitter, one late night on Twitter, where I spend most of my time. But I actually am a member of Goodreads.com, so I got the idea of just basically starting a book club on there, and it was just so awesome that, you know, we had so many people that were really interested and excited about doing a book club, and it just seemed like a really good community and a really, you know, a bookworm's paradise, so Goodreads was, you know, the first thought that popped into my mind. And so I'm really excited about our, you know, our selection for July. I'm excited for our first talk to be on your podcast and our first discussion. And my social media, I'm on Twitter, obviously, under Unicorns and Glitter or Cynthia Linnell. I'm also have a blog where I talk about or write about learning how to program. I'm actually taking classes online to learn web development. And I just kind of blog about my experiences and the latest thing I'm learning. And those are my two passions is learning how to program and learning how to do web development. When I'm not doing that, I'm working as a paralegal in the legal industry. So that's my spiel.
Nice, nice. Well, thank you for being a part of this podcast tonight, Cynthia. And we are going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to introduce our special guest tonight. This is very exciting. Sheree L. Smith is a young adult fiction author who has published four award-winning novels, Lucy the Giant, Sparrow, Hot, Sour, Salty, Sweet, and the California Book Awards gold medalist Fly Girl. Fly Girl is actually listed by the Washington Post as the best book of the year. Her latest novel, Orleans, is set in a post-catastrophe New Orleans and has received rave reviews. You can currently find a copy on Amazon.com or on her website, www.sherielsmith.com. Welcome, guys, Sheree, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Hey, how are you?
Good.
Like that applause track.
That was awesome. I'm going to get one of those.
You're going to get one of those?
Yeah, just to play it when I wake up in the morning.
An applause track just to, with your book, just open the book and the applause track goes off.
That would be actually embarrassing.
I wanted to ask you first about you. What inspired you to become an author in the young adult fiction genre?
Okay, specifically in young adult fiction, well, I've been writing since I was a kid, and reading since before I could write. And I had a moment. I was sort of had a very slow 2-year-long epiphany that I wanted to be writing professionally. And in the middle of that, like, I knew I wanted to write. I always thought I would just write science fiction because that is a lot of what I was reading. And one day I was in a library and there was a father with his daughter, and she brought over a stack of books to him and was like, "Daddy, which one of these should I read?" And I looked and I realized that some of them were books that I had read when I was a kid that I loved. And I ran over to them and I was like, "You should read this." And I started pulling them out of her pile and sort of assaulted this family and was like, "Read this and this," and started pulling books from shelves. And I completely freaked them out. But as I was doing it, I was kind of like, "Oh my God, these are the books I love, because they're the books that shaped you as a person." And mm-hmm. And it suddenly, I just sort of realized that these were the most important books to me in my development as a human being, and I kind of wanted to give back in that area.
In your bio, you also worked for Disney for some time and worked in animation. So tell us a little bit about your experience in that in that environment, and did that help facilitate and help create more stories in your mind to do a story like Lean?
Well, so Disney, that was it's been a long time since Disney now, but it was pivotal in me becoming a writer, in a good way and in a bad way. It was a crucible in a lot of ways, where when you work for Disney, which is can be such an amazing place, they do a very good job of buying up the best talent they can find, and then they own what you create. And so my time at Disney, I actually worked in story development for direct-to-video animation, so feature-length sequels like Lion King 2 and Hunchback of Notre Dame 3.5,
wow.
and stuff like that. And we came up with stories. We would come up with stories, and then we would hire writers to actually write the screenplays. And so I learned a lot there about story structure, which has served mm-hmm. me in great stead as I moved on. But at the same time, the only thing I could write was stuff for Disney. And I got to a point where I felt like I was a shaken bottle of soda with a bunch of good stuff inside wanting to come out that I couldn't release. And so I left Disney. And, I sort of took my little toolkit of story structure that I'd learned, that I'd really honed there. I'd learned it before, but I sort of honed it there and mm-hmm. applied it to my own work. And, as a result, I have a film degree from NYU. So I have a film background and animation background. So I tend to, I try to write visually. So I think that's been the biggest influence.
Nice. And Cynthia, I know you've got some questions too, so I wanted you to get some in there.
I do. Also, I think I saw something on Twitter mentioning about Comic-Con. Is that something that you're into as well, or is that?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Are you also?
So I'm a comic book nerd to an extent. I grew up reading not great stuff like Sad Sack and. Illustrated, Classics Illustrated, but somewhere in my 20s I moved to LA and I didn't have a job, and I found the local comic book store and I picked up a copy of Sandman, Neil Gaiman's Sandman. It was the Kindly Ones graphic novel, and I fell in love with it, and I started reading more comics. And then, as sort of luck would have it, after I left Disney, I temped for a year at a construction company, and then I ended up getting a job at a comic book company. Bongo Comics is owned by Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. And so I was in administration there, but I did some writing for them, and I was there for 9 years. And somewhere between Disney and Bongo, I started going to Comic-Con. I was working at Disney. I said, "I think we should go to Comic-Con and see what this thing is about." And I went to San Diego Comic-Con. And then the year that I was working in a construction company, I was like, "I really liked Comic-Con. I'm going back." And I went on my own. And then I got a job where I got to go every year. So mm-hmm. this year, now I've been going on my own for a few years. I happened to marry a guy who goes every year and was very impressed when we met.
Nice.
And I was like, "I've been going to Comic-Con for 7 years." He's like, "I've been going for 9. And, so we got married. And so that is definitely something I do. I do it every year. I've got a table in the small press area with a couple of my girlfriends. We're called Tired Girl Collective. And I make weird stuff, jewelry, and sometimes I'll do short stories. that I publish under my little imprint called Bookish Press. And my friend is a fantastic digital artist named Ren, so she does all sorts of stuff, and it's fun.
Cool. And is it something that you're doing this year too, or do you have like a display there?
I'll be there this year. We've had our Tired Girl Collective table in small press in the small press area for I think this is our 8th or 9th year. So we'll be doing that, and then I will be doing a couple of signings and a panel. I'll be moderating a panel for YA chicklet, sci-fi chicklet YA stuff on the Saturday of the show. So, yeah, you can pretty much find me there every year. I think I've
awesome.
Been once since I started going.
Cool, good stuff. How long have you been writing, and does writing come easy for you, or is it challenging?
I have been writing since elementary school. I remember writing a poem in probably 3rd grade that a friend said was good, and then I thought, I can write. So I've been writing since then, but I have been published. Let's see, Lucid Giant, I think I finished it in 1999. And that came out in 2001, maybe, something like that. So I've been published since then, and it's really hard until it's really easy. So that's the only way I can describe it. It's like there are these moments where, like right now, I'm working on a manuscript, and I feel like I'm climbing uphill through oatmeal. But then you'll get these moments where it's like you're sliding downhill on a toboggan and it's awesome and everything is coming together and it's a rush. So it's a little bit of both. You just kind of have to take it as it comes.
Nice. Got a little bit of feedback in the background, so I'm not sure.
I thought that was like a kitchen band. I wasn't quite sure.
Cynthia, is that you?
It's quiet on my end.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure the reception's good. Okay. All right. So we actually already have some questions on Twitter, and we even have someone waiting to call in and speak to you. I'll first go ahead and address our first question on Twitter. Looks like this is from Shantae Petoskey. She says, as a YA writer, do you feel pressure to make every book into a trilogy?
That's a great question, because I've sort of had the opposite experience. Anytime I say I want to write a trilogy, for some reason I get the response of, why not just write one book? And I've said, well, you know, A, usually I write standalones. My first 4 books are all standalones. I've had a couple of ideas that I really felt needed to be bigger and could be trilogies, and I've met with reluctance, and it seems interesting. Like, I've had editors say, oh, nobody's doing trilogies anymore, which I think you can all agree is not the case, but there's something driving the trilogy thing where, you know, people want to write books that get turned into movies. The movie studios want to buy trilogies because then they have a franchise. So people start writing trilogies. But the person taking the risk there is the publisher, who is gambling on the hope that all 3 books actually sell or get made into a movie or something that will drive the sales. So it's a push-me-pull-you going on. And I don't feel pressure to write a trilogy. I would love to write a trilogy at some point. I think it would be interesting to stay with those characters over more than one book's worth of development. But it's not all that I'm about.
Well, I think a lot of the feedback that I was getting from Orleans was, well, first, I love the book. And at the end of the book, I was just hoping that Finn would make it. But a lot of the question that came up was, would we find out what would happen to Finn in, like, future publications of Orleans, or if that's just something that is beginning, or, you know, what can we look forward to for that? Because I think that would be an awesome continuation.
Thank you.
Finding out what happened.
Yeah, there is more in the world of Orleans. If I am given an opportunity to tell that story, I will do it. I would love to. There's definitely, it's a much bigger world than one book can really explore. So this would be one of the ideas that I would love to expand on, but it's a matter of what the marketplace will allow me to do right now. So, I don't know. Write a letter to your senator. Hey, I want more Orleans books.
Petition.
And then I'll see what I can do.
Well, that's good to know. So then you're basically saying Fenn's story will continue, because we're kind of left.
The story of Orleans will continue.
Oh, okay.
I can't give any spoilers, because if there's only ever one book, then you'll always wonder, well, what did she mean by that? And,
right.
You know, and if there's five books, I'm not planning on there being five books, but if you know, I get to do a couple of other books, I don't want you to be like, well, she already said that the dog dies at the end, because that'll ruin it for you. So I'm not going to say anything.
Okay, fair enough. Fair. Oh, Cynthia, you had a question?
I did. Can you guys hear me still?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Also, for the characters, well, I could identify the best with Fenn. She's headstrong. She knows what she needs to get done in the book. She's resourceful. She has Lydia's baby, and, you know, she's what they called her, fearless. Is mm-hmm. how Lydia described her. And there are some Daniel. Daniel was kind of like the unfortunate events of Daniel. But
he's the opposite.
I guess, yeah, but I guess, like, was there a model character you had, or maybe a person that you knew long way back when that inspired you to do the characters the way, how you've written them?
I'm sure that people definitely influence different aspects of my characters, but it's very rare that I just model a character completely on a real person. I think I've maybe done that once in my entire writing career, and it was a small part, so I felt like, and unlikely that the guy would ever read the book, so it didn't worry me at all. But Fenn, she just kind of showed up in my head one day, and only thinking back on it do I believe that some aspects of her are based on my mother, who was a really, really tough woman when she needed to be. And specifically, there's this story she said to me once. We were just talking about something. And she goes, oh, you know, that reminds me of when I was in third grade and Miss So-and-so, some girl, attacked the teacher with a knife. And I stood up and took that knife from her. And I said, you did what? She's like, oh, yeah, you know, she was coming down the aisle with the knife out, and I just stood up and took it from her. I was like, how old are you in third grade? I'm like, you were like 8 years old, and you took a knife from someone. Seriously, Mom? And she's like, well, you know, it just seemed like the right thing to do. And I'm like, so what happened? She said, oh, that girl got so mad, and she said she was going to beat me up after school. So what did you do? She's like, oh, I left school early and ran all the way home. I'm like,
wow.
That's an 8-year old. I don't know about the whole knife fight thing, but, you know, that doing what is needed in the moment definitely was something my mom could do. And so Fenn has a bit of that. I'd say, actually, if you put Fenn and Lydia together, that might be my mom.
Nice. Okay. Good stuff. Well, we do have somebody waiting on hold. I don't know if they're calling in or they're just calling in to listen via Skype, so I'll go ahead and patch them through.
Okay.
Area code 931, you're on the air with Black Girl Nerds. What's your name and where are you from?
My name is Austin, and I'm from Tullahoma, Tennessee. And I'm wondering, what's your favorite book that you've written?
My favorite book that I've written? First of all, hello, how are you?
Great.
Good.
Hey, Austin.
And I have to say, Austin, I'm thrilled that it's a male voice calling in. That's kind of exciting. I know that Black Girl Nerds is meant to be all inclusive, and it sounds like it's working. My favorite book that I've written, I have to say, is always the thing that I'm working on. You can be proud. You love all your children, but it takes so much to write a novel that you really have to be into it while you're writing it. And so all of that sort of love and I don't know what the right word is for it, but all of the power that's needed to write a book has to go to the next thing, goes to the thing that I'm working on right now. So it's a book that you have yet to hear about, and you'll probably have to wait a while for. But I'm proud of Orleans, I will say. I'm proud of all of my books in different ways, but Orleans was a long journey. It took me longer to write Orleans than any other book for a variety of reasons, and so I'm proud and happy that it's done.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Austin. It looks like he had dropped off the call.
Oh, well, I hope he heard some of that.
Thank you for that question, Austin. That's good stuff. We also have another question on Twitter, and then I also want to get to some of the questions that were addressed from our Blurred Book Club members. Tatiana Christian, she's a co-host here on Black Girl Nerds. She asks, Cherie, did you experience a lot of problems as a Black woman working to get published as a first-timer?
No, I did not. And I'll tell you how my first book got published. I think I said already that I decided to leave my job at Disney and write. And shortly after I left Disney, and this was absolute kismet, I got a call from a guy that also worked at Disney, and his name is Garrett Hicks. And he said, "Hey, Cherie, I hear you're leaving to write children's books." I said, "Yes." And he said, "I wish you'd told me because I'm leaving to represent children's authors. And let's have lunch." So we actually ended up meeting for dinner, and he became my manager. And at the time I was writing, I had some picture book manuscripts that he shopped around for me that didn't go anywhere, but I was working on my first novel, Lucy the Giant. And when I finished it, he sold it in 2 months, and I was on my way, and it was just the most amazing and gratifying sort of I did the right thing by leaving my day job and doing this. And so skin color didn't have anything to do with it at that point. I have run into some things here and there where they're not everybody, but I've had a couple of people have certain expectations of what I should be writing about because I'm African American. But for the most part, it has not it hasn't affected my work that I'm aware of.
Good stuff. All right. Go ahead.
There was actually I'm on the Goodreads site right now, and there was a few questions on here from some of our members. Let's see. One question from Lucretia was, can you speak on the role of religion played in the story, the idea of churches being a safe place in Finn's mind, but turned out to be not so safe is interesting.
Okay. The role of religion in Orleans. Well, New Orleans, I remember taking a tour of the city once, and the tour guide saying that the only thing that there were more, they had more churches than bars, but it was almost even. And it is a city that has a religious history. The Ursuline nuns that are in the book actually exist down in New Orleans and have been there since before the Civil War. And so it struck me as necessary to have some aspect of that in the city. And also in a dangerous place, I like the idea of there being sanctuary. You know, it's Quasimodo gets sanctuary at Notre Dame, and anybody out there who's ever watched Highlander knows that churches are sacred ground. And so I like the idea of putting something like that in the city. But I think, you know, it's a gentleman's agreement when you say, like, this is neutral. This is neutral territory. And so it felt right to me that, you know, that Finn might try to trust something and have the ground pulled out from under her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, I think one thing that stuck out of my mind was Mama Gentile, the church front where they go for sanctuary, and then you get a sense that something's not right, but you're not sure what, and I was just like, run, leave, run away.
It gives you a bad feeling, right? And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when I was growing up, a church was a church, and I don't know if it's times have changed or what, but out here in California, I have friends whose churches are in random buildings. They don't have steeples and cathedrals, and I know somebody whose church is in a former Italian restaurant. I know somebody whose church actually meets in the party room above a bar. They don't use the bar while they're at church, but so they're all these sort of non-traditional places. Additionally, there are former churches out here that are deconsecrated, and now you can rent them out for weddings or parties. And so thinking you found a safe place because it looks like it's a church doesn't always mean it's a church. Mm-hmm. And yes, that sense of, I mean, I'm glad you got that feeling of something's not right here, because that's Orleans. You have to look over your shoulder.
And also, was there an idea that you had for the Delta fever? I know that was like a really big theme in the book, and it was the reason why the colonies had to section off according to their blood type.
Right.
And I remember reading through the book, and I'm like, okay, what's my blood type? And I had to call my mother.
Right. Well, you know, so my mother was from New Orleans, and she moved away when she was in her 20s and moved back when her parents were older and needed some care. She moved back down to the city. So her parents had passed on, but she was still there living in the house she had grown up in when Katrina hit. And she was trapped in the city for about a week before we could get her out. And during that time, she'd tried to drive out of the city, got caught in floodwaters, and had to wade through the floodwaters to until somebody could save her. And actually, somebody came by in a swamp boat on a street and, like, saved her. But when we finally got her out to Los Angeles, she had it took a couple of days, and she ended up in the hospital. She'd contracted an infection from the floodwaters, coupled with the stress of everything, and she was a diabetic. And she ended up delirious with a fever in the hospital and was there for several days. And that really terrified me. And when I had the idea for Orleans, which I came up with around this time, I was thinking to myself, oh, you know, it'd be interesting to write a story about the city, but I don't want it to be about race, because there had been a lot of talk about, you know, Mayor Nagin had said, oh, New Orleans is a chocolate city, and there was talk about racism in the rescue response. And I was like, what if it wasn't about skin color? What else can you divide people by? And it occurred to me, blood type. And I was like, oh, that'd be interesting to have blood tribes. And I was like, well, why would you need to do that? And I thought of my mother and her illness, and kind of created a disease, and then made a point of sitting down with some biologists and doctors and going, is this possible? Can this be a disease, and how would it act? And then sort of develop Delta fever from there.
Wow. Nice. We got a caller on the line, so I want to go ahead and bring in our next caller. Area code 305, you're on the air with Black Girl Nerds. What's your name and where are you from? Caller, you're on the air. Hello. All righty.
We lost.
It happens. Yeah, it happens. On Twitter, we got a question from Haley Ryan. Haley asks, "Who are some of your favorite authors?"
Some of my favorite authors. When I was younger, and I still admire her work, Susan Cooper, who did the Dark is Rising series, which I absolutely love, and Lloyd Alexander with his Pride and Chronicles and Book of Three. I used to hate Ernest Hemingway, and now I appreciate him. And I think it's an age thing. I had to read him when I was, 15 years old, and I was like, I don't know why this old man can't just catch a fish. And reading it as an adult, his work is a different experience. Marion Zimmer Bradley, Mist of Avalon, I think is a phenomenal book. And E.B. White, Charlotte's Web, that's my all-time favorite book. And then there's just a lot of stuff out there now that I think is interesting. Tanith Lee has some beautiful, beautiful fantasy. The Tales of the Flat Earth series, or Tales from the Flat Earth series, is absolutely amazing. Very sort of Arabian Nights, and she does an amazing job of weaving mythology across time in her books. She's fantastic. I could name more people. Virginia Woolf, there's somebody who's not science fiction or fantasy, but impresses me.
There's another question on Goodreads as well. Michelle asked, did you draw on any images or drawing or music as inspiration while writing?
Any images or music as inspiration while writing? For Orleans, it's something that's fun. It's something that I think is cool. Like in a lot of comic books and indie comics and graphic novels, the artist will tell you, I was listening to this music while I drew this sequence. And I don't really listen to music and register it while I'm writing, but I keep thinking, like, I'm going to do a playlist one day for a book, and I realize that it would be a very short, boring playlist. But for Orleans, the images weren't actual photographs. It was just things from my memories. Having visited my grandparents a lot through my life, I've spent a lot of time in New Orleans, and so certain things like the size of the Superdome, and also knowing that the image of the Superdome changed after Katrina, I knew that I wanted to put something with the Superdome in the book. Jackson Square, which is where the book starts off with Fenn on the levee overlooking the cathedral in Jackson Square in the French Quarter, which is near Café du Monde, the famous café. I knew I wanted those places to be in there. I almost wanted it to be like, and I considered doing this in the beginning, a travelogue. I had actually toyed with the idea of each chapter opening up with an excerpt from a travel book from, like, our time period of what the area would be. So I made sure to try to go visual in that respect. Songs and things like that, not really. The one sort of pun that you'll get in the book is Mama Gentil's church, the House of the Rising Sun, which is a song about a whorehouse in New Orleans. There is a house in New Orleans they call the Rising Sun. It's been the ruin of many a poor boy, and you know that I've been one. But it's also, this is going like an extra layer of nerdy deep, it's also a Star Trek reference. The original series, they're on a planet, like they're on a Roman planet, and there are these slaves who've escaped, and they all say that they worship the sun. And it takes Spock, I think, half the episode to realize that they mean the Son of God and not Apollo. And so those were all the dorky things that went through my head as I wrote that into the book.
Good stuff. On Twitter, we have a question from @AdgePants. She asks, why did you make the decision not to have Daniel as a love interest for Fenn?
why did I make the decision to not have Daniel as a love interest for Fenn? I think I've written about this, actually, to quote Short Round from Temple of Doom, "No time for love, Dr. Jones." The idea that in the middle of all of the craziness that that you'd want to waste your time making out with some boy did not strike me as a very Fenn sort of thing. You'd have to be a different sort of girl for it to be a love story. And this is more about love of tribe and love of family than it is a romantic love story. It just it didn't feel true to me. And think about the world of Orleans, it's a pretty dangerous place. And you know, if you fall in love and you get pregnant, you're kind of screwed if you don't have a tribe, like literally. And pregnant women have half again as much blood in their bodies as women that aren't pregnant. So you'd be a target there. Obviously, it slows you down. We call it a disability here for a reason. So, it didn't occur to me. It just didn't feel like true.
Well, I remember in the book. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just kind of adding on, but I remember in the book there was a part where Daniel and Fenn are making their way through the rooftop, and Daniel falls through, and Fenn strikes a deal with some of the scavengers in the area, and she makes a deal with the lead scavenger to help her make a rope by cutting off her hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that, I guess, from that scene, you kind of get a sense of, you know, how she really needs to, you know, really not take into account her, you know, appearance, stuff that
I guess
regular people wouldn't, you know, really consider or would consider an issue, but she just needs to, you know, it's like a survival instinct for her. It's not
a beauty contest, you know?
Yeah.
It's not about how do I look. I mean, there is a surprising amount of lip gloss and eyeliner in dystopian literature. And to me, I mean, anybody who's just gone on a camping trip that lasted more than a couple of days knows, like, the first thing that goes is your, oh, no, I didn't condition my hair or curl my lashes, you know. So the idea that when the world is ending around you that you're going to take time to dab your lips with a little gloss is, it's ludicrous.
Yeah.
Or it's awesome. I guess it depends on the book and the type of girl. If you're the kind of girl who's like, I don't care if the building's burning down, I'm going to look good, you know, more power to you.
And I had said this on Twitter. I don't even think in a dystopian world where Orleans is based that Fenn would be that kind of girl. I think even just in a regular contemporary world, she would still be, you know, kind of tomboyish, and she really wouldn't be down for some lip gloss. So
that's right. She's practical. You're right. She's practical, and she would. It would be interesting actually to do a makeover. Well, maybe I'll do a short story of Lydia gives her a makeover, and now she would ruin it in the space of a day. You know, it's like giving a dog a bath, and the first thing they do is roll around in the dirt because that's the way they're comfortable. I think Fenn would probably be that way.
Also on Twitter, Tishelle Monet asks, have you ever experienced writer's block, especially when getting to the end of a story?
Writer's block. So here's my take on that. I don't think there's any such thing as writer's block. It's just you have to keep writing. What I'm learning now is you have an infinite number of possibilities that can go next on the page, and your brain needs time to cycle through them all and choose the right one. And so I don't think of it as being blocked. I just think that it's percolating. And in the meantime, if you keep writing, then you're clearing all the bad ideas out of the pipeline until the good one can show up. And so at the end of a book, like usually because of this is part of my Disney training, but I outline my novels before I write them. So I generally, I know how something begins, I know how something ends, and I have a fairly good idea of what needs to happen in the middle. A lot of it changes as time goes on, but I find that knowing the end point I'm trying to get to helps me get there.
Nice, that's good.
Do you kind of write your way through the writer's block, or do you just kind of focus on writing on something else as you're working way through it?
I do all kinds of things. I will just keep writing. Sometimes I'll just write sort of journal to myself. Somebody gave me a good phrase to start with. This is a terrible idea, but if it was good, it would go like this. And just keep writing. And a lot of times I'll sit down and I'll just end up writing, I have no idea what to do here. This isn't working. I have this. And as you do it, you know, ideas start to occur to you. I will talk to people, friends of mine, without telling them anything about the story. I'll just go up to them and be like, okay, if there was a door that was supposed to be locked and it ended up being unlocked, would you go through it? And see what they tell me. And that can help me. I read a lot. Sometimes that gives you an idea. Just going out into the world will help give you more fuel.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of have to keep going. And sometimes you do stop. Sometimes you put everything down and you just go, oh, yeah, I'm going to go take a nap. And that can help because, again, your brain is sifting through the card catalog of possibilities. And you might wake up, and very rarely do you wake up and go, eureka, I've got it, and run off and write again. But shortly thereafter, it usually comes.
Good stuff. One of the things that I found interesting is the character of Daniel. Daniel was a very polarizing character for a lot of us. Some people really liked him, and others were very irritated by him. So can you talk a little bit about Daniel? And then we had a couple of questions on Twitter. One's from Stephanie Rogers. She says that Daniel's naive idealism contrasts well to Fenn's hardened realism. Did you ever consider Daniel being a female character too?
Okay. Well, Daniel, it's funny to hear that he was polarizing. And I think it's kind of like, where do you land on Team Fenn or Team Daniel in terms of who you see yourself as being? So I can certainly see why he would be annoying, because he's just sort of not with the program. It's a lot to absorb when you're not expecting the Orleans that he ends up finding. So my feeling was I needed somebody who was clueless so they could see Orleans as a newcomer. And really coming from a first world place into a fourth world sort of space is, you know, it's a difficult transition. And he's sort of always a few steps behind. And it's something I see a lot with people in, you know, in the world today who just kind of don't get that the world is not a theme park and everything isn't safe. There's here in Yosemite in California, in the Yosemite National Park, there was a series of incidents where people were being killed or injured by deer because they would see a deer in the woods and be like, oh, I'm going to take a picture with Bambi. And go stand next to this wild animal and get kicked in the head. And, you know, we're so used to a completely sanitized world that we do things that, you know, on second thought are extremely stupid. But a lot of people just kind of don't get it. So Daniel sort of is modeled on that sort of view of the world and, you know, comes from a much more privileged place. Now, as to whether or not I ever thought of Daniel being another female, in the earliest days, some of the images that popped into my head of this story, I had imagined the possibility that he was a woman, older than Fenn, older than he is in the book even, that I imagined him as an adult, but that the gender did not matter. I actually wanted it to be gender neutral, that he would never come out, or she at the time would never come out of the encounter suit, would never, you know, the suit itself would alter the voice, so you would not be able to tell if it was male or female. And ultimately, I did not do that. I'm not 100% sure why. I think it helped to have a guy in the book just to sort of balance the gender POVs. And And I wanted Fenn to be able to be female, and her femininity is a hard femininity because it's the femininity of sort of the mother lion, but it's there. And I thought if it was all women, then it would somehow dilute or confuse the issue. And because it's not a romance, you know, I didn't want to imply that it was a romance in any other way. I just sort of thought, like, let's make it your boy meets girl, and there's no love there.
And I think, like, another thing, too, is that I think Finn was, I'm getting the sense that Finn was about around 15 years old or so. And then Daniel is like maybe mid-20s,
yeah,
Daniel, early 30s.
In the book, he's like 24. He's in his 20s, 24. And Finn is 16, actually.
And then
I wanted just to know about Daniel's race. Is his racial background discussed in the book? Because I had thought in my mind he's black, but then others were saying that they see him as a white guy, so I wasn't sure.
Not mentioned at all. It's not mentioned at all. And I don't think that his race is relevant to the story, because what's relevant is that he's from the outer states. That's mm-hmm. the point of differentiation, is he's not from Orleans. That's why you'll notice his sequences are written in the narrative past tense, whereas mm-hmm. Fen is present tense first person, because her life is an immediate thing. And his is not, because he comes from a more sheltered, protected space. Now, if you want to know what do I imagine him to be, I don't think he's black, but I haven't really decided or thought, well, he must be this, that, or the other. It depends on, you know, if I were to ever journey with Daniel into the outer states, he comes from a place of privilege, so whatever that looks like in the outer states is what he would probably be.
Okay.
I keep interrupting.
Go on.
But I kind of got the sense that I really couldn't place, the racial makeup of Orleans. I got a sense that it was just mixed of different people, because you mentioned that, or Finn in the book says that she's like learning Spanish, and then there's Chinese and Korean, and there's like a mixture of all these languages and French as well, and she's able to kind of like blend in, I guess, as far as her mannerisms and dialect goes. I think that was an issue too, with kind of reading through the book, when you get to her section and she's using a different diction, and in the beginning it was a little difficult, but then towards like chapter 5 I'm able to kind of, I understand what she's saying and what she's doing, and I thought, well, maybe that's part of her accent as well as being an Olean.
Okay.
But from my overall sense of it, it seemed like it was more like something that came up in the book was, or I guess a quote that stood out in my mind was, if people were divided along medical lines, would race or gender matter? You know, and it just seemed like it didn't matter what race that anyone was in the book, because you know, everyone was just basically divided based on their blood type. And I think the ABs were like the zombie of the group you went away from. You just knew that if you're in their area, to be on your guard. And, you know, that just seems like a totally different situation than, you know, what's going on now, I guess.
Right. So, yeah, the whole, my hope was that race would not come into play. Race was not meant to matter. You do have certain things like, because my idea was, if you're separated by blood type rather than race, eventually people are going to intermingle, and you're going to end up with everybody's sort of multiracial. The sort of handful of standouts there were specifically in Shangri-La, the fishing town she goes to, which is predominantly Asian, because the fever didn't affect Asian populations in the way it affected other races. And that is something that, you know, in my conversation with doctors, that was something that they said it certainly can happen that way, where some races are just affected differently. So I thought it would be interesting to do that, to still have sort of a little enclave of a specific culture in a place that is otherwise sort of a melting pot.
Mm-hmm. On Goodreads, Evelyn asks, what was that in the rooftops that was going to eat Daniel? And she also wanted to know, I want to know that too. And then she also asked, what was the deal with the stuff?
Oh, hold on. I'm sorry. I can't hear you over the feedback.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Cynthia, are you okay over there?
I'm okay.
Okay. And then the second part of Evelyn's question was, what was the deal with Mr. Go? Was he a bit shady like Daniel's data link had suggested?
Okay. So what was that in the rooftops? We may never know unless we go back down there. It was some animal of some sort. Now, you know, if you're like me, you grew up with the stories of people letting baby crocodiles and alligators go in the, you know, flushing them down the toilets, and that they live in the sewers of the cities and they get really, really big. It could have been something like that. My idea was that it was something that had been distorted, something natural that had been distorted by the, you know, the chemicals in the water and all of the things that had happened in the Delta since the wall went up. And so it was something horrible is the answer. It was something horrible. And, you know, I don't know if we'll ever get to see what it was, but it's kind of better not to. I think it's scarier if you don't see it. And the second part of the question was about Mr. Go. Is he as shady as Daniel's information would lead you to believe? It's an interesting question, because I think that for the purposes of the story, Mr. Go is exactly as he is when we meet him. You have to figure that the information available to Daniel is going to paint everybody who, anyone who decides to stay in Orleans when the wall goes up, they sort of surrender their image to whoever's writing the history on the other side of the wall. So Mr. Go is most likely being somewhat misrepresented by the information Daniel has. But he clearly came from a place that might not have all been kosher. And I think that he, like so many of the people who chose to stay, is trying to make amends for things he did in his youth. He's trying to right a wrong that he might have allowed to happen or caused to happen.
Another character that stood out in my mind was Father John, I believe his name was.
Yeah, Father John.
And I think Finn, like when she describes how she's separated from her parents, and her parents meet some unknown fate, but you get the sense that she's pretty much, her life with her family is over, and she's trying to make her way through to Mr. Go, and I think Father John. And then she actually has, when she's older, and she has Lydia's baby with her, and she finally reaches Father John, and he seems, you know, by this time, I'm just trusting no one in the book, because
okay.
Everything that happens, it's like, oh, you can trust the person. Oh, no, they have some kind of agenda. But then you get to the, you know, the church again, and Father John's there, and it seems like finally, you know, he may be able to help her, but then he's saying, oh no, Nola, she's infected, and you know, it was just that, I guess that kind of created more doubt, because of, I don't think, even though Daniel had his faults, I don't think he would have lied to Finn that way, as
right.
far as, you know, her child, the baby being infected.
Right.
But at first I thought, you know, Father John, you know, how could he try and use the child to satisfy his own agenda? But then, you know, going, I guess, based on the history, from what it's saying is that he was one of the first people to come over the wall and help with the illness. And he has to eventually watch his own staff die, his own nurses and help die. And then he's like the last person standing. And then he starts kind of questioning everything, like, maybe I'm being punished. Maybe something overlooked, and that I'm being punished for his, he said, prideful, being prideful that he couldn't get sick. Mm-hmm. And now he's, you know, kind of in this like downward spiral thing where he's, I guess, going through his life and having all these regrets. And then I think in the beginning it was like, I guess the transition of my thought for the character was, you know, as a child, don't, you know, obviously don't hurt any kids or children, but then you realize that the kind of world that I guess happening in 2054, I think, was the setting of the year, was that even, you know, kids can be used in a blood farm or can be used for whatever adult or whatever, you know, anything that came in their path. But I think that was like another character that stood out in my mind. But the way Finn handles it, you know, it just seems like she is just always realizes what's happening and realizes that, okay, this is, she's like singing the song that the doctor or that the father was singing. And I just thought, okay, yeah, go back and get the baby.
So the song was a trigger for you.
The song was a trigger for me because Finn mentions the song that he's singing as he's, I guess, prepping the baby or taking the baby from Finn. And then later on she leaves and then she starts humming the song and then singing the lyrics. And I thought, wait a minute, he's singing about the blood being pure. And
Good. I'm glad. It sounds like that worked. I remember that song from a screenwriting teacher of mine. Was actually writing a screenplay and about, I think it was about somebody whose mother was trying to get him to pass for white because, you know, he had some African-American blood in him, and she would take him out to this place in the woods where a lady would straighten his hair for him. And that movie, that screenplay started with a tent revival, and they were singing that song. And that must have been, I don't know, I think I read her screenplay 20 years ago, and it stuck with me. And I was working on this book, and I was like, you know what song he's singing? He's totally singing that, because once again, it's about the blood, and it's about, because for her, the thing that was stood out was there's a line about being whiter than snow, which was important in a story about somebody who is passing for white. But for me here, I was like, it's all about the blood. That's kind of awesome. And it's interesting how you you sort of pick up these tidbits and you hold on to them for many years without knowing why you still have this thing in your pocket. And then one day you're like, oh, I know where this goes. So that's what that song was for me.
Nice. I wanted to also go back to some more questions we had from our Blurred Book Club members. Stephanie asks, what made you decide to go with a science-heavy book in this way? And did you feel limited at all trying to write around the input you got from your scientist friends?
Okay. You know, I feel like you need to come up with rules in any story, but particularly in a speculative piece. You need to come up with rules so that you know how the world is supposed to work, and then do your best not to break those rules. So when I came up with the disease, I knew that at some point I was going to have to make it as believable as possible, which is why I did the science research that I did. It's also really helpful as a writer, and here's a tip, if you're ever stuck, do some more research, because guaranteed you will discover something that helps you with your writing. And for me, I had this lunch with this great doctor, and told him what I needed. I need a disease that can do this. And then he described to me what things could do, and I was like, okay, great. What symptoms would that have? And then being told that there'd probably be anemia and there'd probably be jaundice, and that could lead to things like pica, disease that makes people eat dirt because they're missing minerals, and so you'll see like that happens with Daniel's little brother, that he just wants to eat dirt, and that sort of stuff just really added flavor and then gives you ideas for, oh, I could put that in the book in this scene. So no, I didn't feel limited by it. It helped me sort of, it helped me build the world. And was there a second part to that question?
And did you feel limited at all trying to write around the input you got from scientist friends?
Okay, right. No, I didn't. I found that it helped me. I can't recall anything I had in mind that I was like, oh, shoot, I can't do that now. Because, mm-hmm. you know, that, yeah, no, I really sort of tried to build it. What I will do is write the story I want to write, and then I'll do some more research, and then I'll tweak things when I discover, like, that's not possible or that is possible.
And then Heather go ahead.
Sorry.
Hello? I just want to, hopefully you guys can still hear me. I don't know if that interference is on my end or not, but it's quiet in my room, I swear, I promise you. I guess a question I had was, I guess towards the end of the book where Finn gives Daniel Enola, and she, I guess, tries to warn or tries to direct or divert everyone's attention to her, all the soldiers on the wall to her. A thing that kind of confused me was that, I guess, Finn being so young, because I, even though she's capable, I see her being capable, but I still see that, okay, she's just a kid. She's only 15 years old. But for Daniel to kind of let her go, and I don't know if it's a sacrifice or maybe, you know, maybe she should survive in the later series. But was that kind of like when you were writing, was that something that you kind of had or kind of saw everything going towards? Or did you think maybe it was or was it kind of like planned that, okay, as you're writing, it kind of directs them into that direction? Or did you just kind of had everything planned out before?
I didn't have the middle of the book planned necessarily, but I always knew how it would end. And that is because of Finn's journey. She has, you know, Finn is probably one of the few people who could survive on her own in Orleans. And she'd done it before when she was very young, so being older, she certainly would be even more capable of doing it. But she goes on that journey, and that's what each of the books that the novel's divided into sort of reference, that she goes from being this loner to being part of a tribe to becoming a true leader. You know, I think the last section of the book is Shepherd, and that she's willing to sacrifice herself for others, which that's not the girl we met at the beginning of the book. She might, you know, pretty much the only person she'd sacrifice herself for in the beginning of the book is Lydia, and that's it. And here she learns, it's her journey towards basically understanding and becoming more like Lydia. So I always knew that was going to be the case. The other thing to recall is, with the exception of maybe Mr. Go, people don't have that huge of a life expectancy in Orleans. So that's why Mr. Go is the oldest man in the Delta. And, you know, so being 15 in that world is probably akin to being 30 in ours. And her knowledge of the world definitely makes an impression on Daniel, who knows he wouldn't have lasted a minute without her. So I don't know that he's looking at her as a little kid when it comes to the end. And they are both focused on saving that next generation, on saving the baby.
We have a caller on the line that's waiting to talk to you, so I'm going to go ahead and bring them in. Area code 718, you're on the air with Black Girl Nerds. What's your name and where are you from?
Tatiana. I live in Philadelphia.
Hey, Tatiana.
Hey. So I had a question. I'm sorry.
No. What's your question for Sherry?
How long did it take you to write the book? I know you mentioned that you did a lot of research. So I was just curious if you just like sort of sped through it, or if it was like a gestation period of like 5 years, like 4 years, type of thing.
Well, I started, let's see, I had the idea for the book
right after Katrina, so 2005. But at the time, I was working on my previous book, Fly Girl. So I didn't start Orleans until, I think, 2009, actually.
Oh, okay.
So it was a long time before I started it, and I had an outline. I sort of, you know, as things would occur to me, I'd write them down. I had an outline, and I was sort of thinking about world-building stuff, but it was sort of that idle, that's what you do when you're sitting in the car sort of thing. And I was mostly working on my other projects. And then I got a writing retreat at a place called Hedgebrook up in Washington State, which is an amazing place. It's a farm that has little cottages for women writers to go and just write. And they feed you and take care of you. And, yeah, read more about it, hedgebrook.org. It's an amazing place. But I went up there, and I had a two-week residency in February of 2009, and I wrote my first draft of Orleans. And it just it took me those 3 years to finish the book, and it was a long journey. And part of it, the story has changed over time. The basic story is the same. There were a few other characters that either were expanded or reduced over time, or it went back and forth. My original editor on the novel, Tim Travellini, he got downsized, and I got a new editor, Shauna Rossano, and so things changed there. You know, there was a transition period, and there was just sort of a lull in between the two of them where I started to feel a bit lost because the landscape was shifting beneath my feet. So it took a while to sort of remember what this book was, and I actually ended up back at Hedgebrook in another retreat. And I'm sorry, it just sounds like somebody's throwing away recycling.
Oh. Yeah, there's a lot of feedback.
Yeah, I don't
sorry
know what it
about
is.
That.
It's completely quiet in here, but okay.
Yeah.
And so I ended up back at Hedgebrook, and I met a woman, a beautiful writer by the name of Rana Reka Rizzuto, who has an amazing memoir called Hiroshima in the Morning. And she was very funny and supportive. She knew I was struggling. I was like, I'm trying to finish this Orleans book, and I've been talking about it, and everybody's waiting for it, and I'm just not getting there. And she did me the greatest favor. She did a tarot card reading for the book.
Cool.
Not for me. She, like, went back to her cabin, and she's like, okay, I read the cards. And it was interesting. She said, it looks like there's three characters here, and one of them is like a stone in the middle of a river, and it's stopping the flow.
Oh.
And I knew exactly what that character was, and it was a character that somebody had suggested I expand, and I knew I had expanded her beyond her role. And so I almost completely removed her from the story. She's mentioned, but she's not in it really, and it just made all the difference. And so, you know, it was sort of a journey of discovery of what's the best way to tell this story as opposed to what's the story about. So, yeah, 3 years. It's the longest I've ever taken on a book, and it was painful. But I'm glad that I did it.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Did you have any other questions for Sheree, Tatiana?
I guess that's it. Was it like a long, was it sort of a similar process to sort of get it edited? Like, did it take a long time, the actual editing process, once it was ready to be submitted?
You know, it did. Well, so this was a book that I sold it on the idea. And
okay.
Then I had to write it. So I wrote a draft and, wrote a few drafts, basically, and submitted it as my first draft. And took a long time to get notes back from my editor. And when I did, I'd already started rewriting it anyway. So there was this long sort of back and forth process. And I think that was part of the issue. Like, with your first novel, generally you've written it completely. It's exactly what you want it to be. You sell it,
mm-hmm.
and then they give you some notes, and then you can, you know, haggle over the notes. But when you sell a book on the idea, which I've done a few times now, but I've decided I don't really love it. It's great that somebody thinks your ideas are so great, they want to pay you. You're like, yes, this is awesome. But then you end up with somebody who's looking over your shoulder while you're cooking.
Mm.
And sometimes that's great, you know. Sometimes you have the person who's exactly like, oh, I think that needs salt, and that's perfect. And sometimes you have the person going, is it ready yet? What is that? And, and you know, and I just, I'm one of those people that, like, don't look at me when I'm trying to parallel park. I get a little nervous. And so you know, it's harder to make the book the thing you want it to be when somebody is giving you feedback early on. And so that was, I think, part of what made the – it was sort of editing while you were writing, and I think that that is not always the healthiest idea.
Oh, I see. That makes a lot of sense.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Cool. Well, thanks for calling in, Tatiana.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. All right, we've got a question on Twitter from Heather. Heather read the book with her 12-year-old daughter, Ashley, and her daughter wants to know why Fenn chose a tree for Lydia's burial place.
Ah. In my mind, the trees were a natural place to bury someone for two reasons. Because a lot of New Orleans is marshland and swamp, you can't bury people in the ground there. Historically, they used to bury people in the levees, and then the river would rise and the bodies would float up. So if you go to New Orleans, all of the cemeteries are above ground. They're mausoleums and they're crypts. And so in a world where you don't necessarily have the resources or the time to build somebody a marble monument to stick them in, a tree is a convenient sort of receptacle. There's also, I think it's the baobab tree, I remember reading a long time ago about a tribe somewhere that would bury their dead in the trees, and it completely freaked me out. But now that I'm older, it seems like a practical thing to do.
Awesome. And then we also have a question here about Enola. She, let's see here, Ajpants asked, I felt like Fenn was giving up on life, and it was a bit out of character when she thought Enola was infected. Expand on that a little bit about their relationship.
Okay. I think that she's absolutely right. Fenn was giving up on life. And, you know, something that interests me in people in general, what makes them keep going? And I kept thinking to myself, well, what is the thing, what's the worst thing that could happen to Fenn? What's the thing that would make Fenn give up? And she's invested her promise to Lydia and basically her future in this child. And you'll see that shift sort of halfway through the book where it stops being just about I promised Lydia and it starts being about I care about this baby and I want to give her a better life, not just because I promised it, but because that's what I want for her too. And to have failed and know that, like, as we've been talking about, like, nobody, you can't trust anybody. And knowing that there's one more child that is going to have to somehow find a way to survive that, I felt that that is the thing that would break Fenn, if anything could. And so I thought, like, okay, what would she do? And now remember, when she leaves the baby with Father John, as far as she's concerned, that's a good thing, right? It's supposed to be a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's not abandoning the child. She's not, it's not like, oh no, and it's not a murder-suicide or anything. She leaves the baby and she walks away because she's, how much can you take? And that was my feeling of what was going on with her until she realized that, you know, things weren't what they seemed.
A lot of people on Twitter, too, have been sort of having fun with the characters in the book, and we were sort of discussing if this book was made into a movie, who would you cast as some of the actors? And a couple of people brought to mind Quazne Wallace as Fenn. Kyla Pratt was another actress. Do you have anybody in mind who you'd like to play Fenn if there was a movie version of Orleans?
You know, I it's so funny because I will think that when I read books, and I don't know why, but on Orleans, I just draw a complete blank. You know, like I suppose I could see Morgan Freeman as Mr. Go.
But when someone just tweeted that.
There you go. But when you think of like Fenn or Lydia, it's funny. It's like I always think things like, oh, I could totally see Angela Bassett as Lydia, but she'd have to be younger because of the world that the story takes place in. And I tend to think of actors as they were in certain movies rather than as they are right now, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you end up casting things with like, oh, a young Bruce Willis and a slightly older, you know, Keisha Knight Pulliam, which is not my bid for anything, believe me. Or maybe a remake of The Bodyguard. But it's, you know, it's very hard for me to picture. So who do you think? I would love to hear what you think.
I was thinking of, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, but Quvenzhané Wallace for Fenn.
Quvenzhané, yeah, from the Southern Wild.
Mm-hmm.
If she was a little
yep.
bit older, you know, she has to grow up some, and she would be a pretty fierce character. Yeah, I could see
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and, I mean, I had envisioned Daniel as Black, so apparently I'm the only one that thought that.
No, that's fine. Who would you cast?
I would cast Chadwick Boseman. He's my new favorite guy right now, so I love him. He was in 42.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So,
I could go for that.
I would cast him. Cynthia, do you have any suggestions as to who you'd cast?
As Fenn, no one said Keke Palmer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, from Aquila and the Bee.
Aquila and the Bee.
I
yeah.
was
right.
Yeah.
Right. I could see that.
And then, like, for some reason, brother, I forget his name.
Davis.
Brother Davis, I think was his name was.
Brother Josh.
The one, he was the one that had, or Fenn described him as having like a greenish hazel eyes color or something.
Oh, yeah.
For some reason, I keep thinking of that actor. He played Tea Cake in the movie with Halle Berry, but I keep thinking his face.
Oh,
for some
Michael
reason,
Healy. Michael Healy
yes.
is, you know, yeah.
Michael
I was thinking him as Brother Davis for some reason, but I, for Fenn, in my mind, Keke Palmer, I was thinking first, my first thought was probably Angela Bassett, but, you know, the age issue. But,
and then a lot of folks on Twitter also adding into the mix, Amanda Stenberg, she played Rue in The Hunger Games. So
okay.
she would be good for Fenn.
Awesome.
That's interesting. I mean, you could play this game for hours, couldn't you? Like, how about this person, that person? And it's, I don't know. I'd be happy to see any of these people. I think it's hilarious.
Do any of the characters in the book, I know you attached Fenn and Lydia to your mom, do any of the characters represent you? Are there some elements of your personality integrated in some of the characters?
No, I'm not that interesting or cool, I think. You know, I'm not crazy enough to go over the wall like Daniel. I'm not sort of badass enough to do any of the things that Fenn does. Maybe I'm like Enola. I'm a big crybaby who needs to be saved. I tend to write people that I think are, my heroines tend to be much more adventurous than I am. And, gosh, in Orleans, I might, except for the fact that I'm not a scientist, I'm probably most closely aligned with Mr. Go, because he kind of just hangs out in his space and watches what happens outside, which I think is a very writerly thing to do. But, one day I'll have to write a book about me, and it'll sell one copy to my brother who goes, yep, that's right.
Well, we're about 5 minutes into the end of our podcast. Cynthia, did you have any final questions from Goodreads, any of the Blurred Book Club members, questions that they posted before we wrap this up?
Let's see. I think we've covered, well, I think we've actually gone through a good number of questions. Just checking real quick here. Is there anything on Twitter?
Yeah, we got a lot of other questions here. One question I did see posted about the idea for Delta Fever. Where did you get that idea?
Oh, I think we talked about that a little bit. The idea of Delta Fever was after my mother was evacuated out of New Orleans, and she came down with a fever from an infection from the floodwater. And that's sort of part of it. And just knowing how it's something that happens a lot in any place that floods. It's like the water becomes so incredibly toxic. And from flooding sewers and burst pipelines and everything, and you do not know what you're going to end up with. And that's, you know, you only have to basically watch the Deepwater Horizon pumping out all that oil into the Gulf to think what a nasty brew you could come up with.
Where can we find out more information about your books, any sort of book tours that you're doing, any functions that you're speaking at? Where can we find that information on you?
Anytime I'm doing something, you can read about it on my blog, which is called The Middle Hundred, and you can link to that through my website, which is my name, ShariellSmith.com. I try to post things on the news page on my website, but if I can't make it there, then it'll be on my blog, and I often will tweet about something if I'm going to be doing anything that day. So those are the best places to find it. If you want to read more about the book, you can go to my website or do a search. I did a blog tour back in March when the book came out, and so there are a few interviews and things floating around out there about Orleans.
And can we also reach you on Goodreads too, or do you have a? Are you a member? I guess
I am not a member of Goodreads. It's
oh,
a horrible
you gotta
thing
do that.
That apparently I have to do that. You know, I think I mentioned it to you earlier. I'm sort of a troglodyte when it comes to all the social media, and I'm not a joiner. I keep having to sign up for things. I only started Twitter this year, and I still find it strange. So eventually I will join Goodreads. I just, I'm a terrible, like I said, I'm Mr. Go living in my little compound and, you know, reading a book rather than going online and telling people what I'm reading. So I'll try to change.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Cherie, for being a part of this podcast. Thank you guys for tweeting us your questions, for the folks that called in. Cynthia, thank you so much for co-hosting this podcast with me tonight. This was really great. And if you guys haven't read Orleans, please pick it up. It's a really good read. You can go on Amazon.com or Cherie's website, www.CherieLSmith.com. Next week, we will have guest Melissa Lowry, the director of the prolific documentary film Black Girl in Suburbia. So tune in next week at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Black Girl Nerds podcast. Thanks, ladies.
Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Finally, I'm finally free. Finally.
finally